The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week we're looking at the science of aging. We'll discuss the biological, genetic, and social forces that affect our health and the ways that they change over a lifetime. We'll speak with Dr. Nir Barzilay, director of the Institute for Aging Research at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. But first, we're joined by Professor Diana Koo to discuss her work at the UK's Medical Research Council as the head of the world's longest-running birth cohort study. Enjoy. I'm speaking with Professor Diana Koo. Professor Koo is the director of the UK's Medical Research Council Unit for Lifelong Health and Aging, which is where the MRC National Survey for Health and Development is based. She's been a member of the NSHD research team since 1987, becoming the study's third director in 2007. Professor Koo is the author of two acknowledged key texts and an internationally recognized leader in the field of life course epidemiology. Thanks very much for being here, Professor Koo.
It's a pleasure.
So can you give us some background on the survey?
The National Survey is the oldest of the birth cohort studies in the whole world, and it was set up in 1946. It was initially a maternity survey of all the babies that were born in a week in March 1946. So that survey would cover just over 13,000 babies. And some of the striking findings that came out of that were things to do with the fact that only 20% of the mothers in those days were getting pain relief of any kind. And there were huge inequalities in the survival of the babies, in the how many babies were low birth weight, and in the quality of care that the mothers were getting both during their pregnancy and during childbirth. So there was a book written within 2 years of the survey, and which caused quite a stir, Maternity in Great Britain. And it was because of those sort of findings that James Douglas, who had a real foresight in those days, decided it would be really good to follow up a sample of those babies. And just under 5,500 were selected, and they became the National Survey babies, and they've been followed up ever since. And they've just turned 65 in March.
So were there specific questions that the survey as a whole was intended to answer?
Well, the questions have changed as the study has gone on. The children have grown up, science has changed, social context has changed. But I guess you can identify four broad periods of the study. The first was, if you like, in the first 5 years when there was a follow-up of issues about their growth and development, for example, and the children who, their motor milestones, those who had early infancy respiratory problems. So a lot of actually questions about health and what kind of social and biological factors impacted on the health of the children before the age of five. During the school years, James Douglas saw a real opportunity to test the new educational policies that had been brought in after the war. In Britain, most children were selected at 11 plus to decide whether they went on to a grammar school education or a less selected education. The children in the survey had cognitive tests at 3 time points, both before and after these 11 plus examinations. And he was able to show that the children who were equally able but from poorer backgrounds were not as likely to get through the tests. He also showed later on that they were less likely to stay on at school. In fact, they had less education opportunities than their more advantaged peers. So that was what the school years were very much about. But they continued to collect, you know, data on heights and weights and puberty and all kinds of factors that we now look at in relation to their adult health. So the third period was then when they became early adults, and by the early 30s, Mike Wadsworth, who had taken over the study by then, really brought the focus back onto their health. And the study had been funded by the Medical Research Council since 1962, so it was a natural thing to look at their health. In those days, health was seen as disease and disorders and defects, but Mike argued that we needed to look at quantitative traits, the distribution of health that everybody has, so things to do with, you know, like blood pressure or lung function, later on there are things to do with cognitive function in adult life, the physical performance tests where we actually test to see if other people have the capacity to undertake the daily tasks of daily living, for example. So those tests were brought in, and what the study could show, which was one of the first studies to be able to do this because it had matured earlier, was that these early experiences that the study members had had in terms of their growth and development, both physical and cognitive, and their early social experiences, a lot of links were found between those aspects of their early life experience and many of the aspects of adult health. I think the surprising finding was that it was shown across so many different outcomes. Not in the same way every time. You know, for example, big babies have a higher risk of breast cancer in later life, but low birth weight babies have a higher risk of cardiovascular disease. And there were different pathways. It wasn't like something was determined and nothing could ever change.
Right.
I kind of see it as like a big bowl of fettuccine where you're trying to disentangle the pathways. You know, is this a biological pathway? Is something really, you know, happened early in life, which has added a risk to that person's susceptibility to a particular disease or outcome? Is it a social pathway? You know, is it a behavioral kind of pathway? And how is it modified by what experiences they have later on in life? So now we're just entering a new and, I mean, related but very exciting phase because we've been doing the most intensive data collection we've ever done on them in the last few years, and we've just finished just the day before they turn 65. And we've been bringing them into clinics rather than sending nurses to their homes. So we've been able to do much more intensive measures of their physical and cognitive function and to get more, for example, biological markers, blood samples and urine samples. And with this, we'll be able to really study how they age in later life and, you know, who maintains their health and function as they age and who has accelerated aging. And so we've done heart scans, bone scans, for example, so which we've never done before. So it's a very exciting time.
So let's just be clear. Now, the survey itself doesn't show causal relationships necessarily, correct?
Absolutely. It's an observational study. It shows associations, and because we have data from across the life course, you can try and at least, if you like, exclude certain pathways that, you know, where you think something maybe to do with a smoking. Was that the reason for the relationship between particular early life experience, like early poor social class and poor lung function, for example? Looking at these intermediate factors, you can exclude some pathways. You can't necessarily identify the exact pathway, but I think that's for other kinds of studies to do. But I think the fact that we have shown so many kinds of associations and robust associations, and then also gone and looked at those in other studies, so you can go and see if you find the same associations in those studies. So all this builds up more robust evidence that might be more useful for policymakers.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. We're discussing the UK's Medical Research Council National Survey for Health and Development with Professor Diana Koo. And we'll be right back after this brief message.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And now back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. My guest is Professor Diana Koo, the director of the UK's Medical Research Council National Survey for Health and Development. So what have been the most interesting trends that you've found in the data over the years?
Linking on what I've said earlier, that there is this, for example, consistency and persistence in the social inequalities in health that we see as the children first grew up and then became adults. And in some ways, people would say, no, that's not very surprising, we know all that. But the reason we know all that is because studies like the National Survey have been following people up for a long time. So, you know, what is interesting to me is that the socioeconomic circumstances in which a person was living when they were age 4, for example, can have a lasting impact on a whole range of different kinds of outcomes. Obesity, blood pressure, mobility problems, memory, respiratory, and I think it's that kind of persistence, even when you take account of what happened to them later in life. And as I said before, this is not because I'm saying it's a very deterministic thing, but it's something that people need to, and health professionals and need to take into account when people, when they arrive in middle life, they've all come from different pathways, and some of those pathways will have made them more susceptible to things that are going to happen to them in later life. And being able to kind of identify the people who may be more susceptible gives us a real chance to offer more help to them, so that you could actually perhaps change the trajectory they're on. So we've been quite interested in the last few years, now that we've got repeat measures of many of these quantitative measures like blood pressure and obesity, for example, you can actually look and see how men and women are changing over time. For example, when this is a very interesting cohort for obesity, because as children, they didn't really have much obesity in this cohort. If anything, there's trouble at both ends of the spectrum, is how I put it. There were undernourished and maybe rather scrawny kids who've had problems later on, and also then there were the people who started to put on weight in their early adult life, and some of those have really gained in weight, and they also are experiencing more problems. So, for example, if you take something like metabolic function or diabetes, there's good evidence that both, if you like, the low birth weight babies didn't do so well, and that people who put on weight early in adult life in this cohort also had a higher diabetes risk. So it's often pays to be kind of average and normal in these cohorts. So we've been looking, for example, at blood pressure recently, and trying to see whether we can identify a group of people whose blood pressure accelerates particularly fast, say, from their 30s onwards. Could you identify them earlier from factors that they've experienced, and therefore perhaps, you know, target them for treatment perhaps earlier if that was required? And something like, for example, birth weight, it will predict what your blood pressure level is at 36 in our cohort, but it doesn't actually at this moment predict the change in the blood pressure between 36 and say 53. But something like obesity and early childhood social circumstances predicts also the change in the blood pressure into middle life, probably through the fact that people from poorer circumstances had this bigger gain in weight in adult life.
Right.
Another trend that's related to that, I think, is the fact that it's actually very hard to disentangle whether it's timing of when you put on weight or the duration of overweight that really matters, because what this study shows clearly for this cohort, and I think other cohorts have also shown this, that once you've put on weight, it's actually quite hard to lose it. And so those who put on weight at 26, you know, at 53 were still by far heavier than those who had not put on weight at 26. So it's those kind of trying to disentangle those kind of pathways. It's a fascinating process.
Well, in effect, you provide raw data to researchers, so that as a jumping off point, let's say.
Yes, absolutely. Cohort studies are seen primarily as hypothesis generating. What we do is first, also when we see interesting findings, we would be looking across other cohorts to see if we can see this in other cohorts. Is this a universal finding that may give a more of a hint that there may be something biologically going on, as opposed to if you can break the confounding with other cohorts, and some factors may be just because of the social context in which these people grew up, and that in another generation you might not see those effects.
Do you have a favorite bit of research that's been based on your data? Or is it like children and you're not actually allowed to have a favorite?
I've looked at many things, and I've been a bit of a jack of all trades in my time. But we did study the women quite in detail as they went through the menopause for several years, and I was in charge of that study, and I found that very interesting, because what we found there was more developmental factors that predicted timing of menopause in these women than I could the adult risk factors, like smoking, which will advance the timing of menopause. Parity, the more children that women have, usually they have later menopause. But we were able to show that both early growth, poor social circumstances, and what was quite surprising was our measures of childhood cognitive function actually predicted timing of menopause. So the girls who had higher test scores in childhood actually came later to menopause. What was
interesting
most interesting about that? Yes, and what was really interesting about that was the earlier we measured cognitive function. So we measured cognitive function at 8, 11, and 15, and the earlier measures had the more striking associations with timing of menopause. So I've been really intrigued by that and went to, and I found the same findings in another UK cohort study, and there have been also, it's been reported in two other studies. And so in other studies they're now doing, is this a genetic effect, is this an early life effect, an early environmental effect that's both affecting cognitive function, your lifetime cognitive function, and your perhaps your lifetime reproductive function. We don't know if it's a genetic effect or an early environmental effect yet, but it's a pretty robust effect and, of course, gives us clues onto aging in more generally, because reproductive aging and the aging of the body generally, people are interested to know how related those are, and those are things that we're now looking at with our new data. So, for example, you know, menopausal characteristics, how are they related to the cardiac structure and function that we've just measured, but I can't tell you the answer to that yet because we've only just got the data. You know, that's something that I've been very interested in. The other thing I'm very interested in is what I call the measures of physical capability, the capacity to undertake the daily task, the physical tasks of daily living. So we do some quite fun tests with the study members, which they have a good laugh about, where we get them to stand on one leg with their eyes open and then with their eyes closed. We time how long they can do that for. We get them to do chair rises and how long it takes for them to stand up and sit down a number of times. And we measure their grip strength, for example, and their gait speed. And again, it's been really interesting to these, what you would think would be quite noisy measures, not very precise measures, but you see these really interesting patterns and different kinds of patterns relating these measures at 53. We've just got new measures in their 60s, but relating these measures at 53 to a whole raft of both types of factors I mentioned before, their growth and development, their cognitive function, their social circumstances, their behaviors at different stages of life, how well they're exercising even 10, 15 years earlier. So I think these are really important. And although they're simple markers, they've actually been shown by our team and by other teams in the States to be very summary markers of aging generally, if you like, of multi-systems, so that people who have had these measures, it predicts later health, later survival, those kinds of things.
So where do you go from here? Because at a certain point, you are going to, and I'm not sure of the way to put this, but you are going to run out of participants. So do you plan to restart the study? I realize a survey like this is very expensive.
Well, I think we actually offer quite good value for money. And of course, we get scrutinized every 5 years about what we've achieved. The Medical Research Council sends many of our peers around to check out on our research, but also on what we want to do in the future. And, of course, every time that we do this, we have to show the numbers that people would be expecting to still be alive on the study, that we would be able to still recruit into the data collections. And we did a little calculation the other day that 1 in 10 of this cohort, according to current trends, would still be alive when they're 100. So that's quite a long time away, and certainly, well, they're 65 now, there's a good 30 years left in this cohort, which would, I mean, bring us down to a number that was still actually quite reasonable in terms of other cohort studies that have taken place of very elderly people. And we do our very best to maintain these study members in the study, to get good response rates, to keep those numbers up. And I think the study members, we've just had, for the first time, we've just actually allowed them to meet each other at some of these birthday events. And they show the most amazing identity with the study. It's been actually a real thrill, a real buzz this year. And I think it's been really good for the young researchers to see how committed the participants have been for 65 years and the stories they have to tell about what the study has meant to them. They say we're the only people who've never forgotten their birthday. So that's nice. So it's had its effect in a number of ways.
Absolutely. It's fascinating and it's far-reaching, and I'm looking forward to the continued research. Thanks very much for being here, Professor Koo.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
One more thing. The National Survey for Health and Development website is fascinating. If you'd like to try out the cognitive tests that the study members were given, we've included a link at skepticallyspeaking.com. The tests look at verbal and nonverbal reasoning, reading, and mathematics. The members took the tests at age 15. Good luck. We'll be right back to talk about the biology and genetics of aging after this.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
I'm here with Dr. Nir Barzilai, endocrinologist and the director of the Institute for Aging Research at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and the director of the Nathan Schock Center of Excellence in the Basic Biology of Aging of the National Institute of Health. Thanks for being here, Dr. Barzilai.
Good evening from New York. Nice being with you.
So tell us about the Longevity Genes Project.
The Longevity Gene Project was an idea that came after I started asking people if they think that we humans age at different rates. Let me ask you, do you know somebody who's 50 and looks like he's 60? Do you know someone who's 50 and looks like he's 40?
Absolutely.
It's a real bad question in an audience because everybody raises their hand. We apparently know intuitively that we age at different rates. So there's biological differences between us, right? So maybe the best thing to do is to go to the extreme. Go to 100 years old because they have lived longer. They probably looked younger than their age at any decade. And let's go and ask what's different about them. And maybe by that we'll understand a little bit more about aging.
Now, so this is the Longevity Genes Project. Now, you've profiled a number of people for the videos. You've done videos for the people in this project. Can you tell us about some of them? Because they were amazing.
In order to be in our study, you need to achieve a few things. First of all, you have to be healthy and independently living at age 95. By the way, if you reach 95, you could be in any shape after that, but we want to do the best of the best.
Right.
Second, they have to have offspring that can participate in our study also. And third, our aim is a genetic aim. We want to find genes that are controlling aging or promoting longevity. And when you do a genetic research, it's always best to focus on a certain population. You know, if I would go outside in New York City, the races, the colors are just amazing, but not good for genetic studies. So we decided to focus on a very special population, and that is the Ashkenazi Jewish population. Most of the Jews in North America are Ashkenazi in origin. Because of this history, they're very similar genetically, or they're more homogeneous, and it's easier to find genes when you don't have to account for lots of noise that you get in the genetic background.
So now the people, now you mentioned that they have to be healthy. So you mean mentally as well?
Actually, we are saying that they have to declare that they are healthy. We do also a cognitive function test, and those who think they are healthy are doing relatively well in those tests. They had to be independently living, feeling healthy, and cognitively well adjusted to their surrounding.
Well, that's one of the things that struck me about the videos, is that all these individuals are very articulate and thoughtful, which is not necessarily what one thinks of when they think of people that are a century old. So do any of the people that you're studying at all have Alzheimer's?
Typically, the 100 years old have a cognitive decline, but also typically they don't have this disease we call Alzheimer. This is an age-related cognitive decline rather than the disease that's called Alzheimer's.
So what makes these people that you're studying different from the other type of 100-year-olds?
I think that they are probably representative of a 100 years old across the world, and some of the 100 years old are at the end of their life. Some of them would continue to live several years. So there's variability, but, you know, again, what's unique about them is some of them are just as incredible as 70 and 80-year-old grandparents that you all know. They have genes that allow them to get 30 years older, and they just are better as they get old, and you don't see that they're slowing down. So the point is, it's possible for us as humans to achieve good health, good cognitive function at age 100.
So what do these people have in common? What are their lifestyles like?
Among many questions, we ask them an open question. Why do you think you live to be so old?
Right.
And we get basically two answers, almost always. One is family history. My mother was 102 and my grandfather was 108. The genetic story of their longevity, and that's very common. And then we say, okay, but now tell us the truth. Did you eat yogurt all your life? You know, were you vegetarian? And here is where it's starting to be really, really interesting. Those people did not do what we tell our patients to do. 40% of them were overweight or obese at a retirement age. More than a third of them smoked for over 30 years. I have a woman who's smoking for 95 years. Less than 20% of them were doing any sports like golfing or swimming or something like that. Drinking, which is good, if you do once a day a drink is good, very few of them are doing. Only 2% were vegetarian. They are not representing what we tell our patients to do. They got there no matter what they've done, just because something was protecting them.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm discussing aging with Dr. Nir Barzilai, the director of the Institute for Aging Research at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and the principal investigator in the Longevity Genes Project. So let's go back a bit. When we talk about aging, what are we talking about exactly? What is it?
You know, that's a great question. And unfortunately, I'm not going to give you a good answer because we're all trying to figure it out. The simplest way to look at aging is to say that this is something that's related to our chronological age. And chronological age is probably not reflecting our biological age. What's important to know about aging is that aging is the risk factor of almost every disease that concerns us or eventually kills us. It's cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and Alzheimer's. The risk of any one of those diseases go by 100 to 1,000-fold when you go from age 40, 50 to the ages 70, 80, and 90. And our concern, if to speak skeptically, which would be appropriate, our view is that if you're not going to understand aging, if I cannot come with a better story than what I'm telling you about aging, trying to avoid the definition, I'm skeptical that we can do anything more in treating those diseases that I mentioned.
I'm wondering how we should look at aging itself. Should we look at it as a disease or as an accumulation of damage?
Let me tell you how governments across the world are looking at it. Aging is not a disease. And it's a real problem for us, too, because we have several drugs that we think are going to be at the heart of aging. But you cannot get an approval for a drug if it's not against a specific disease.
Right.
As long as aging is only a risk factor and not a disease, it's going to be a real problem for us on the level of definition and on the level of practicality. I said that aging is the risk factor for all those diseases, and if we don't understand aging, we're not going to cure diseases. And I think we can see it happening with the example of cardiovascular disease. Heart attacks are being prevented all over the world now. We have statins, we lower the lipids and the bad cholesterol in people. We give them aspirin, we treat hypertension. When they get heart attack, they get stents, they get bypass, they get medications. So you know what happened to those people who are now recovering from heart disease? Well, within a year or two, they get either cancer or diabetes or Alzheimer's. And I think that's a real problem because we're not dealing with the aging. We're dealing with only one way to treat a certain disease. So that's why I think aging has to be redefined so we can start understanding that and treating it.
So you're talking about heart disease. So what else is associated with age? What exactly is going on with our bodies as we age in regards to cells and organs and neurons and such?
We have a lot of breakdown. Our robustness is really gone. We are suffering from organs that are not doing what they should do. In the same way, we're talking about cells that are depleting in one place and maybe are increasing in other places where we don't want them to increase. We're getting to cells with so much damage that either they die and get out of circulation, or worse, they don't die but become cancer. We're talking about effects that can be noted in the brain and in the heart and in the muscles and in the adipose tissue, and it's a really generalized form of deterioration that eventually leads to those diseases and to death.
Well, here's where your project comes in. What makes that happen? What makes us age?
Yeah, this is a hard question. You'll ask scientists, and some of them would say that we have a clock, and the clock just ticks, and with time, there are certain things that are under control of this clock, and they are just accelerating our aging. Other people, and I would say most of the scientists, don't think it's a controlled process. It's just a process that happens, and it has just one direction, and this is downhill. And that's as far as I care to talk about it without going into a biological conversation.
Let's look at genes specifically. So what role do genes play in the aging aspect?
That's a good question. It's also a little bit controversial because the answer to this question in the Board for Geriatrics is that aging is 80% the environment and 20% the genes. And so the question, when this is the answer, is asked by demographers. They are taking data on population. For example, they are taking age of death of fathers and their children. And they show that the relationship in a statistical analysis is accounting for 20% of the variable. But it's really not fair to look at it like that because no matter how you look at it, we are with our genes in this environment. And we start 50-50. We can have better genes, we can have a better environment, but it's all interaction. So I don't think it's important to know what's the relevant contribution. If we understand what's the role of the genes, we'll understand how they protect us against the environment. It's as simple as that. My grandfather, who, when he was 68, he had a heart attack and he died. My father, when he was 68, also had a heart attack, and he had the triple bypass, and he unfortunately died last year, but at age 86. So on one hand, you say, well, the age of death of my father and grandfather are not related. But on the other hand, they had the same genes that gave them the heart attack at the same year, at the same age. But what happened in between is medical progress. Triple bypass wasn't available for my grandfather. So I think it shows you what's the role of the environment, the change of the environment, and the interactions with the genes.
So regardless of whether it's 80-20 or 70-30, the genes do affect the process. So how does that work?
So we discovered several genes that are associated with longevity, and we're thinking that maybe they're causing longevity or contributing to the longevity in our subjects. And each one of those genes has kind of an interesting story. Some of them are conserved in evolution. In other words, they work not only in us, but also in animal models. Dwarfism in nature is associated with longevity. The ponies live longer than the horses. The little dogs live longer than the large dogs. When you take mice in the lab that by chance had those mutations in the word dwarf, and you look at their lifespan, it's much longer than those without the mutations. If you take and induce a mutation in the growth hormone axis in mice, they live longer. So it looks like dwarfism is really good for aging. We have found that 2% of our centenarians have functional mutations in the growth hormone axis, and in fact, they were shorter, older life than their friends, and they had some alteration in their growth hormone that is typical of mild dwarfism. So it kind of shows that whatever we knew from nature is still probably relevant, or at least in part relevant for humans, because we can find it only in centenarians.
Every time I read about aging, telomeres keep popping up. Can you explain those?
Yes, and they certainly popped up in our research, and actually we published a paper where we showed that longest telomeres were in centenarians and that they were inherited to their children. Telomeres are caps at the end of the chromosome, and every time the cell will replicate, the chromosome will be transcribed from those telomeres. But every time that the cell will divide, those telomeres will become shorter and then shorter in the next division. And people have noticed that with age, in animals and in humans, the telomeres are getting shorter, and they're probably getting shorter because of what I just tried to describe. Mm-hmm. The question is it causing aging, or is it just associated with aging? I think that the long telomeres are in the healthy subject. That's why when the subjects are healthy, they have long telomeres. It's not that the telomeres are making the subject less healthy. The cause and effect here, I think, is very confusing. And on top of that, there's another phenomenon that is really very important when we think of telomeres, and that is that cancers have the longest telomeres. So on one hand, telomeres get shorter with aging. On the other hand, with cancer, there's the longer telomeres. And in fact, if you look at most of the models where you're doing a transgenic manipulation that will increase the telomere length, the side effect of this manipulation is very often cancers. So those guys do not live longer, only if you increase the telomeres.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and today we're talking about aging. My guest is Dr. Nir Barzilay, the director of the Institute for Aging Research at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and the principal investigator in the Longevity Genes Project. Let's look at animals. There are a variety of lifespans within the animal kingdom. So why do some live so much longer than others?
The common answer to that is this notion that we have just that many heartbeats that all the animals in the kingdoms are receiving. And we can spend all those heartbeats in fewer years, or they could last us for as long as we save the beats. Because there is a relationship between heartbeats and longevity across the animal kingdom. For example, elephants live one of the longest lives, and their heartbeat is one of the slowest. And, you know, we have a pulse of between 60 and 80, that's the number of a heartbeat in a minute, and mice have twice as long. And it's not really the heartbeat, probably, but it's a reflection of energy expenditure. So if you expend your energy fast, you die sooner. And if you expend it slower, you live longer. I think what's interesting for us more at this time is to take similar species that are close to each other but are greatly divided by lifespan and try to understand what makes them live longer. This is going to be the thing that maybe is going to tell us more about mechanism of aging than just looking at this association between long and short living animals.
And I read recently that animals that reproduce asexually have special mechanisms that delay aging. Is that correct?
Right. In fact, to the extent that a lot of investigators don't understand why sex was developed, because asexual reproduction seems to have benefits for aging for some reasons that we're trying to understand.
Well, I guess it would also decrease the genetic diversity if we were solely reliant on asexual cloning, let's say.
Well, that's the common answer, but, you know, when you test it in the field, it hasn't been shown to have an evolutionary advantage.
Really?
Yeah, it's a big thing now in evolution, and I read about it from time to time. But I have to say there's a very important theory of aging that you exchange longevity for reproduction. In other words, if you reproduce less, you live longer. And it's actually been shown to be true in many species. And we also just started showing in some presentations that our centenarians who, by the way, have to have children. I think that there's a lot of centenarians who don't have children, but they're not in our study.
Mm-hmm.
Our centenarians have on average less than 2 children per centenarians, while our control at the same time, which was in the 1920s and 30s of last century, had many more than that. So the exchange between aging and reproduction is kind of very, very interesting.
I am going to be bringing this up to my son at an opportune time. We have a question from the chat room. This is from Brad in Reno.
If we've only got a certain number of heartbeats, does exercise exhaust the allocated beats sooner?
That's absolutely a great question. And let me tell you the one thing that everybody should do to prevent aging, it's exercise. At any age, in any state, exercise is the best. And we have little doubt about that. However, the question is good because one of the things that exercise would do is would increase oxidative stress, which somehow, you know, many people know about that, and many people know about oxidative stress and the antioxidative enzymes and the vitamins that are antioxidants and all these things. So people at the aging field had looked at longevity of animals, whether they increased their oxidative stress, whether they increased the defense against oxidative stress. Many, many models in many, many hands, the majority of those, do not change lifespan. Not only that, recently there are several mutants where they found mutants of worm that we use a lot in research, the C. elegans. And those guys have more oxidative stress, but they live even longer. So the oxidative stress story is interesting story. We probably don't understand it totally, but it's probably going to be the defense against oxidative stress that's going to be the most important rather than the oxidative stress itself. But it explains why exercise, you know, I know that my grandfather, who died at age 68, he was particular in not exercising because the notion was that exercising is bad. You know, you breathe more oxygen. Oxygen is a poison, and he was avoiding it as much as he could. And really the results are the opposite across everything. Every study that you see in animals, in humans, exercise is always of benefit.
I do have to mention, though, when you first brought up the idea that we only have a certain amount of heartbeats, I assumed you were being facetious.
No. Well, I was trying to find a nice way to say that, but I wasn't.
It actually makes more sense now.
Somebody calculated that rodents and humans are using exactly the same, and there is a number of heartbeats for as an average lifespan.
The show is it teaches me something new every week, honestly.
And also you can go and tell your son he's killing you and you heard it in your program.
That, sir, is worth its weight in gold. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. Today's episode is A Lifetime of Data, and we'll be back with more of Dr. Nir Barzilay, principal investigator in the Longevity Genes Project, after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we explore the changing ways that medicine and culture have treated pregnancy and childbirth. We'll talk with doctor and medical journalist Randi Hutter Epstein about her book, Get Me Out, A History of Childbirth from the Garden of Eden to the Sperm Bank. And on another edition of Everything You Know Is Sort of Wrong, Greg Layden looks at common misconceptions about life expectancy. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm speaking today with Dr. Nir Barzilay, the director of the Institute for Aging Research at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He discovered the first longevity gene in humans, and he's now the principal investigator in the Longevity Genes Project. So what's the goal for you personally? Is your objective to enable us to live full lives for longer, or are you trying to find a way for us to live forever?
You know, the first answer is fountain of youth. Let's take our cells that are old and turning to young. It's not going to happen in our time. So this is not a fountain of youth. My research and our research as a community now is not that. Some of us will say, well, how about living to be 300 years old? And I'm skeptical about that too, because I think that our body as a species has the potential to live about, somewhere between 100 and 120 years. Look, the oldest person that ever lived, and we know for sure her age, was 122. Let's say we have this capacity. I think this capacity is also decided not only by biological factors, but physical factors, the way we're built, lots of other things. So I don't think 300 is possible. 100 and 120 years old, I think it's possible, but this is not the reason I'm doing my research either. The reason I'm doing my research is to prevent the chronic debilitating age-related diseases that kills the majority of us.
Right.
If we could have no disease and better quality of life, if there will be a drug like that, we'll apologize that the side effect is longer life, but it's really the prevention of age-related diseases that concerns us as scientists.
So how far along are you with that, precisely, in a non-speculative way?
David Sinclair, who was a scientist from Harvard, showed that the wine extract resveratrol activates a biological pathway that is common in extending lifespan in many organisms. Resveratrol is nutraceutical, and people can take it. In my center, we're doing studies in resveratrol. Dr. Jill Crandall and Meredith Hawkins are doing resveratrol studies and showing that it has very strong anti-diabetic properties if you take enough of it, which is over 2 grams a day, which most people are not taking.
No.
So this is an example of something that could be relevant for aging, of course, because aging is not a disease. Either you take it nutraceutical, or as David Sinclair and his companies are doing, they are developing as a drug, first of all, against diabetes. And after that's successful, you can check if it works against Alzheimer's, cancer, etc. The drug I'm most excited about is the drug that acts similar to what I find is the genetic reason for the high HDL, the good cholesterol in our centenarians. It's something that inhibits this enzyme just as much as it's inhibited in our centenarian and increases their good HDL. And it's going to be for the prevention of cardiovascular disease. But I would be very interested to check it for protection of Alzheimer's, because we show that the people who have this mutation are protected from Alzheimer's and cognitive decline. And lastly, I have my own company with my partner Hasi Cohen from UCLA, where we found another chemical that declines with aging and has many actions against age-related diseases. So this is more in an initial step. We're talking, if everything goes well, as treatment in 6 or 8 years or something like that. But the pharmaceutical, the venture capitals are out there because they understand that aging is going to be a target and that it's going to be beneficial for prevention of more than one disease at a time.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and my guest is Dr. Nir Barzilay, endocrinologist and the director of the Institute for Aging Research at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Now, we have a bunch of audience questions here, so let's see how many we can get through. The first one is from the chat, and it's from Gold.
The Methuselah Foundation is tackling aging from an engineering point of view by identifying things that break down or wear out over time. They're offering prizes in a similar way to the XPRIZE for space flight. Do you know what the current state of play is for the foundation, and what is currently being tackled by people around the world?
This foundation has been associated with the mainstream of aging people. They have some projects that are worthwhile. I think that it is much more important to know that money for aging research is very scarce. The science is really interesting, but the funding is really, really very, very low. So I think it's important to increase the funding at the government level and at foundation like the Methuselah Foundation, absolutely worthwhile.
Next question is from David A.
Are there any foods that are proven to slow aging, like those that include antioxidants? Also, do we know if calorie-restricted diets extend life in humans, as they do in monkeys?
All the research in antioxidants, all the studies that were done right and blinded, have been really negative, and there's nothing for me to add. There's nothing that showed that those foods are important for aging, although there's still questions if they're good for something very specific, you know, for some form of cancer or something like that. Caloric restriction is really interesting because caloric restriction is extending life in many, many species. And it has been a main part of my research and other people's research. It works in specific animals. Not all animals, and the questions of whether it works in humans is really absolutely great. There are humans that are being studied. It's very hard because it's the most difficult thing to do. But I would say that in humans, every year we get an update, usually in the New England Journal of Medicine, that is our Bible. We have increasing number of people that join a study to show the relationship between body mass index, this is our weight corrected for height, and mortality. And it's always a U-shape. When you're too thin, you die, and when you're too fat, you die. Of course, many of us are too fat, so that's what concerns us. But those who are too lean also die. And if you believe that, the best BMI is somewhere where I am, which is a little bit overweight, and I like it a lot. And if you go below that in BMI, and if you go higher in BMI, you're at risk of death. So the question, if you take a BMI that's almost normal and you're going to push it down, is it going to have a benefit or not? There are those group of people that are known as the cronies who believe in this science, to the extent that they're practicing caloric restriction, and their heart's probably better than most of us, but it's not clear if they can handle infection better, if they can handle reproduction, if they'll be immune to other diseases that are very common in lean people. And so I don't know the answer. Maybe for personal reason, I'm skeptical.
We have a question from Jim W.
Are there products or treatments that say that they can increase your lifespan that people should be wary about?
You know, I described the gene that blocks the action of growth hormone that's associated with dwarfism in nature. A lot of people are getting growth hormone as an anti-aging treatment. And I believe that this growth hormone is probably dangerous because in my studies, those that had less growth hormone were the one who lived the longest. To remind the audience on the story of estrogen, growth hormone and estrogen and testosterone are all youthful hormone on a young body. The question is, what are they doing on old body?
Right.
And old body has its own biology. There are lots of things that we can see in old body that are changing the environment, and we don't know the interaction of those hormones on old body. Sometimes things are the way they are to be protective. It is possible that low growth hormone and low estrogen are protective when you're old, rather than just representing the fact that you're not young. And in fact, we know that now that estrogen was stopped in so many women, so has breast cancer incidence decreased. So just as much as that's not a cure, I would say that growth hormone therapy could probably be dangerous if you want to live longer. If you just want to look pretty and have bigger muscle, that's something else.
I'm going to give the last question to our studio technician, Ryan, because he is not with us this evening.
Let's say we can increase lifespan. Could society actually deal with that kind of shift in the population? Would young people be the toiling slaves of the old? Will old people hang on to their jobs with their decades of accumulated benefits and pay increases, leaving fewer and fewer entry-level positions for the young, forcing more and more of the young to take their degrees to Starbucks?
And I'd like to give you some background. Yeah. Ryan is almost done his degree. And so if we could reassure him in some way, that would be lovely.
Yeah. First of all, I made myself clear that for me the goal is to live with a better quality of life. Mm-hmm. So it's not to extend life. It's not to have people who are 100 and 200 years old. Of course, there are all those social issues of social security, retirement age. Every government in the world, for them, the best economy is when you work until you're 65, you retire, and that you die the next day. That's economically
right.
What's really best for the government. So, you know, we have to forget that and go over and see what makes sense to the people. But there's records of what's the cost, the medical cost, in the last 2 years of life of somebody who dies at the age of 70 or at the age of 100. And at the age of 70, it takes 3 times more dollars to die than at age 100. So not only the 100 years old when they were 70 didn't go to the doctor, but their medical cost was third. So there is a lot of dollar benefit by having health. Now, I agree, it's not everything. And you'll have to change retirement, and you have to change Social Security, etc. But this is not a reason to keep us getting old, decrease our quality of life, and die from a terrible disease.
Dr. Barzilay, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
You can find Dr. Nir Barzilay and the Longevity Project at superagers.com. There's also a link to it on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. From there, click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR, 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Lisa Skovanek. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.